This is What We Just Watched. I'm Graham.
And I'm Chris.
We've come together to talk about two television shows, which we've both selected in advance. But here's the big idea.
We don't know what programme the other has picked. It's literally a voyage of discovery. And I mean literally, metaphorically.
But what show shall we look at first?
Well, before recording, Graham and I both competed on the Krypton Factor Flight Simulator.
Now, I brought the BAE-146 down safely with no errors.
Whereas, I regret to say, my descent was a little too keen, and all hands, including Gordon Burns, were lost.
And that means we begin with my choice of viewing. Okay, so let's get my choice of viewing for Chris.
Oh, now this is... It's The Living Soap.
Who's that?
Oh, I have no idea.
I'm going to try and get you to name them.
Oh, God, I don't know who these people are.
There must be one. One of these you must know.
I don't know. I kind of seem to remember like they were called things like Spider. And
there's Spider.
Oh, look at that. Apple Mac graphics and kind of like cut out. It's like a magazine has been cut up and... Oh, look at that.
Okay, so what we'll do is we'll go on a recording break now as Chris enjoys The Living Soap. Okay, so we've just watched the 7th episode of The Living Soap, and it went out on the 26th of November 1993. I mean, the first question is, did you enjoy it?
Yes, but not because it was necessarily a good programme. It's very odd, because it was generally evocative, but in a strange way. It was a big show at the time. Mm. I was in my last year at university when that was on. I remember talking about it with people, and it made a bit of a splash, but very little of it lodged in my memory. Mm-hmm. beyond the opening titles and the M People theme tune. And I think that's because when you actually watch it, it's actually very, very boring.
So if you had to analyze that episode, what are the storylines in that? So it's the 7th episode. What are the main storylines?
The main storylines are, forgive me because I can't remember who any of the people are.
Okay.
So the main storyline in that episode is Spider wants to become a model.
Eat your heart out, Naomi Campbell. Supermodel Spider, hoped her face would make her a fortune.
Unfortunately, she's got a fat nose, which rules her out of... she does get told at one point that she'd be okay for working in Paris.
That's not even her. Someone else has told her they would be okay for Manchester.
Right.
She's just been told that she's okay to live a full life.
Well, see, this is a kind of maybe a signifier of how much of an impact she made on me, that I wasn't concentrating on who was being told what. But so that's the main storyline. Okay. She's trying to become a model. There's another storyline about I wouldn't even call it a storyline. It's just like a film where one of the housemates goes into the countryside. Dan looks at some vegetation,
and then observing what vegetation there is there, and
this was on Friday night TV.
Yeah,
it wasn't exactly the word, was it? That segment.
I would. You likened it to a Why Don't You?
It felt a lot like one of those films on Why Don't You, where a child would sort of narrate, "Hello, I'm Dan, and I like going into the countryside to look at the vegetation, and I really like it because I like vegetation." It was literally very, very dull. One of the interesting things about The Living Soap, it feels in format redolent of what we now know as reality TV. But the way it's made, it's obviously technologically quite contemporary, but at times it felt painfully traditional.
Mm. Could you sum up what Karen's storyline was that episode? What was her story?
I have no idea.
In an attempt to overcome her seminar phobia, Karen's resorted to hypnosis.
That's it. And Matt's storyline?
That was superb. Because we see it as kind of, again, it's a very kind of traditional kind of, he goes to a guitar shop to buy a bass guitar.
What do you reckon? Do you want to go for it?
Yeah, I do, definitely. Can you put a deposit on it at all?
Put a deposit on it, yeah. I mean, it's a straight cash deal, I'll do it for $190.
So we leave that particular scene. We're all on an emotional high. he's got the guitar. He's going to have the guitar. And then later on, we see him in a piece of camera saying that actually...
Due to my financial position, I have decided to knock the idea of buying that bass guitar on the head.
So now we're on an emotional low. So it's very much a roller coaster of emotion.
The episode is punctuated with a couple of to-camera things, and the producer is Spencer Campbell, who claims that he invented the diary room. Now, what's your thoughts about how it's used?
Well, what I would say is the thing that actually it reminded me of more was the video box on Right to Reply. I just feel that they've said to the housemates, please come into the room, talk to camera about what you want to say, and that's it, and that'll do.
There's a couple of times where they're using them to actually make political points, or there's Simon does a piece about supporting your union.
The government's all set to bring in legislation which is going to affect your students' union. Everything you've taken for granted could go.
I find that kind of oddly touching in a kind in a sort of nostalgic way. Take direct action, write to your MP.
Maybe an undertone of what you're saying is there is a real earnestness in the way that now these kind of shows are much more ironic and flip.
Yeah.
Here
yeah.
they want to have real kind of sort of substance.
Yeah. And I wonder whether they thought student life, you know, it's kind of crazy, hedonistic. We're in Manchester. We can just point some cameras at this and we've got gold. And actually, they really didn't have any gold. And I wonder kind of how far they got into it and realised, actually, this isn't really that good. But you kind of feel that there's also a kind of purity to it that kind of which is noble in some ways, that they just want it to be authentic. They just, like I say, they just want to point cameras at student life. But it doesn't always make for great telly.
Where, I'm asking this genuinely because I don't know, where was the Madchester scene? Was this the height of it?
It's kind of post-Madchester. So kind of the height of Madchester is kind of 1990. But one of the things that really, really struck me about the show is that there are very, very few signifiers of 1993-ness. There's very little, we hear very little music. I think the only piece of music, contemporary music, we hear is a New Order track from their Republic album, which kind of soundtracks the modelling agency scene. But if you showed that to somebody and said, what year is this? They would really be really at a loss.
Well, let's talk about what we did see that could be pop cultural to the time. So, for example, the shelves I noticed in the living room are Habitat self-assembly shelves. I used to have those.
Very nice.
We see Simon reading The Face at one point.
I did strain to see who was on the cover of that issue of The Face. I couldn't quite catch it.
We see some Max Pack soups.
We are very, very much pre-Starbucks in this show. Very much. This is such an old canard, but 1993 is as far away from today as it is from 1970. And would you say 1993 is closer in spirit to 1970 or 2016?
That's interesting because I think it probably is closer to 1970 because it's a very papery world, isn't
it?
There's a scene outside, I can't remember what's going on, but there's a, I think is it when Spider's talking about being a DJ and we can see that there are shelves full of leaflets for students to take and things. There's lots of paper around in this world.
I mean, maybe we can't reduce it down to kind of, you know, there's one person has a computer, he's typing his essay. Is it even a computer or is it a word processor?
Because it's white text on a blue screen. I was wondering if it's an Amstrad or something. But this is Simon, who we follow doing his essay at the last minute.
See, I just want to go back there to a point that I made earlier about the kind of the traditional nature of the making of the show. Is that particular, there's a particular sequence in the show which juxtaposes Simon writing his essay late at night. So you kind of see him typing away, and there are close-ups of the clock, which are getting progressively later and later. And this is cut against... other housemates who
well,
are
it's
at
a karaoke. It's yeah. Karen at the karaoke.
But the kind of the traditional kind of here's one student diligently typing his up his essay during the night and juxtaposed against here's his housemates who are having a brilliant time in inverted commas singing. I was a bit amused by the fact they're doing Carpenters songs in the karaoke. I was trying to work out whether ironically liking the Carpenters would have been a thing in 1993. I don't think it was. I think they were just the songs and that they had in the karaoke bar.
I want to actually follow on from what you were saying about the Carpenters and the possible irony, because I've also, if you look in the house, some of the bedrooms are bedecked with Thundercats and Superman wallpaper. Now, when I watched that, it surprised me because I thought, is that quite early for that kind of ironic nostalgia?
Mm.
But maybe this is, we're on the cusp of it. Maybe
I think we're on the cusp of it. 1993 was the year that Select magazine did its British, well, it did kind of a celebration of British pop and British pop culture, which effectively spawned Britpop.
Mm.
And I think part of that whole scene was a kind of ironic sensibility.
Or well, with anyone for that matter, as long as it's not you. It was between me and that person concerned. So to sit at the TV and call me a and incident while I'm not there, which is, like, I thought, really sort of courageous of you.
I'll call you a to your face, Simon.
It's got nothing to do with you.
Arguments. Now, there are arguments that happen on camera, which one would imagine production team are thinking, great, it's on. But my feeling from watching it was there's no context to any of the arguments.
No.
And, well, you said something to me about the style of the arguments they were having.
Well, they're very kind of those kind of drawn out kind of arguments where you get the sense that both people really, really want to come out on top.
Spider, honestly, you've no right to make judgments on what other people get up to.
So they kind of make kind of endlessly boring kind of riposte to one another. Whereas I kind of think in real life, people would just kind of go, oh, fuck off, or just kind of, they just kind of storm out. But
this is because it's on camera. Is that your point? They want to come across as having the higher moral ground because it's being recorded.
Absolutely.
But you just thought, I know, we'll jump in, getting on the bandwagon, you know, Simon's been a to Claire.
But in another way, they do sort of accurately reflect the kind of slightly pompous and self-righteous spirit you have when you're a student.
Is this because they're young adults who now have their own agency and ideology, and so they want to come across as they're now making mature decisions? And
yes.
They're out-maturing each other, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
I'm really not affected by your opinion at all.
Oh, I'm glad.
Okay, so you particularly want to talk about the post-dated check scene where there is a discussion that Matt no longer wants to have the responsibility of taking the communal money and paying the TV licensing bill because he can't manage his accounts, so he ends up overdrawn. So Dan comes up with a solution, which is they all submit to Matt post-dated checks, which are checks that can be cashed at a future date.
But I love the actual kind of pop cultural antiquity of a phrase post-dated check. Mm. But that scene was quite dull, but it did kind of accurately reflect the sort of the pedantry and the finickiness of student life, in that kind of, if you're asking me to pay £4.50, but my share is only £4.40, I'm not going to give you the extra 10p, Graham. I'm sorry, but I'm just not.
And there's the annoying bit where Emma, who is the young mother, and actually there isn't a lot of her in this episode, she makes that little sideways remark.
It sounds really petty, like, I'm paying £4.50 for something that I don't even use, hardly ever.
Oh, is there a greater signifier of, you know, one's cultural superiority? I don't really watch that much television.
And Dan...
even though the fact that I'm on television...
I want to talk about the visual style of the show. Now,
okay.
In part, there's a kind of a dullness, and it might be because the version we're watching has come from VHS.
Yeah.
It's not a very colourful show.
No.
Do you think in part that's because it was maybe using sort of like news OB cameras? It's still on that very video-y.
Absolutely. I think also there seems to be a lot of footage of them in rooms with the curtains drawn.
Mm. Would that be because the light balance and things like that?
Probably. It does feel kind of quite, again, I mentioned this point earlier, I think, it does feel a lot greyer than I remember 1993. In my head, 1993 is orange, But it seems very grey here.
Talk me through the title fonts. What the conceit is there?
The conceit is that they're the graphics and typography of an Apple Mac.
Why would that be in 93?
I don't know. I kind of get the impression that when they were designing them, that whoever was commissioning them had an Apple Mac and thought, I like those. That looks good. And that kind of looks fresh. The title sequence is very 1993, because that is quite colourful and brash. Mm. And you've got M People.
Mm-hmm.
It's Renaissance by M People, I believe. I think the titles, in a strange kind of way, don't quite set it up for the show it actually turns out to be.
Mm. Okay, so here's a thing I want to get to. It's a quote that I've dug up about the show. And it's around the... There were rumours that Karen, in the show, yep, had a fling with Jason Orange. Okay.
Exciting.
Okay, so here's the thing. I want you to try and guess who has made this quote. I'm going to give you a little bit of background about where this person was when they made the remark. It's from 1994. It's someone posting from the University of Birmingham, and he's on rec.arts.tv.uk. So it's an early news group.
Okay.
And talking to the subject of whether Karen had had an affair. Well, her surname is Bishko. Okay. So right. Karen Bishko. So
right.
This person says, quote,
I met Ms. Bishko at the BBC launch party for The Living Soap last September, and she seemed to be extremely friendly and genuine. Not the sort of person you imagine getting involved with a member of Take That. But I suppose you never can tell.
Who do you think might have been that? It's very much in their kind of oeuvre.
So this person, we're assuming, was at Birmingham University in 1994.
Yeah, who's already along at a launch party for a BBC show, making very clear that he's been to a launch party, his access, so it's a he, who, and someone who still has that MO even today.
Do you know what? I have no idea.
It's Lizzo Mazimba.
Well, I have no idea why I didn't get that straight away.
That's completely his.
Well, he's always in with the big exclusives, isn't he?
Yeah. And I like the kind of the very fussy way that Ms. Bishko... And
pejorative, I feel.
Well, no, I think it's technically correct. That's what he's doing. And
really?
And also, she just doesn't seem the sort of person who would have a fling with Jason Orange. Although, you never can tell.
Well, he's covering all the bases.
So The Living Soap, I mean, it's one of these shows that... As soon as you saw it, you remembered that it existed.
Absolutely.
You didn't necessarily remember anything else other than that.
quite clearly.
So it ran weekly on Friday nights from October until March 1994.
Yeah.
At which point the BBC dropped it and it came back for two wrap-up episodes. Now, can you remember anything about those?
Other than that, I think they were on quite late at night.
They went post-midnight slot on Friday.
Right.
And this time they did employ a narrator. Can you remember who that was?
I don't know. Maura Stewart.
Well, actually, if you go the other way, we were talking about irony and the birth of irony. Who might be a good candidate?
I'm struggling to think of who BBC Manchester would have had in that kind of in that department. No, you're going to have to help me there.
Brian Kent.
Oh, you're joking.
Yeah, Brian Kent.
Oh, you're
two episodes.
Joking. Right, so now I'm about to show Graham my show.
And I can see already that we're freeze-framed on a Thames ident.
Always a tantalising thing.
Ah, keep it in the family.
So what can you see, Graham? What's happening?
I mean, it's one of the greatest title sequences. Fast drawing of the house. And it's sort of sketching in all the characters. Is Robert Gillespie having a cuppa? Does he pass it? He doesn't. There's something wrong with his cup of tea.
Oh, you remembered correctly.
Yeah, they pass the mug around. There's Pauline Yates. Oh, so Jenny Quayle, not Sabina Franklin.
This is pre-Sabina Franklin.
Okay. And Stacey Dorning, who's listening to her transistor radio.
Yes, next to her ear.
Okay. So we'll take a recording break and watch this now, then.
So we've just watched Keep It in the Family, the Thames Television sitcom from 1980. Specifically, we watched the third episode of season one, which was broadcast on Monday the 14th of January at 8 o'clock. It starred Robert Gillespie as the delightfully chaotic cartoonist Dudley Rush, Pauline Yates as his long-suffering wife Muriel, and their two daughters, Susan, who's played by Stacey Dorning, and Jackie, who's played in the first two series by Jenny Quayle. I know you're quite surprised by that, Graham.
I was expecting Sabina Franklin, and I...
Or were you disappointed?
I was. I didn't like Jenny Quayle at all. She seemed very different from the rest of the family. Very posh and kind of horsey.
Why aren't you at work?
This is my sick leave.
You're sick?
No, but there's no point in taking your sick leave when you're ill.
So I have two questions for you, Graham.
Okay.
A, did you enjoy it? And B, did you think it was any good?
That's quite interesting questions. So do you think I could have enjoyed it but not think it's any good?
Yes.
Okay, well, A, I enjoyed it very much.
Right.
B, I thought it was good, actually. It's, there were spontaneous chuckles as we were watching it.
That's interesting.
I mean, it's dated and yes. It has all those kind of things against it, but it's actually, it's very well-paced. Everything
yeah,
goes
yeah,
with the
absolutely.
Real thing.
Yeah.
It's very tightly written.
Yeah.
Everything comes together. There's no flab in it at all, is
there?
No,
that's true. That's true. Because sometimes that kind of... people say that that works against ITV sitcoms, you know, that they're 22, 23 minutes long as against, you know, 30 minutes on the BBC. But in this example, it seems to be a plus, doesn't it?
Yeah, and if you think about that it essentially... Okay, it's a BBC slot versus an ITV mm-hmm. slot. It essentially has the same slot as The Living Soap, and it felt... so much quicker.
So should we talk about the premise of Keep It in the Family for anyone who can't remember it or didn't watch
yeah.
it?
Yeah, so it was a big one for me because I was always into cartooning and comics. Mm. And so the idea that Robert Gillespie is... Well, one wonders what the train of thought was that made yeah. someone think... It's Brian Cooker wrote it, isn't
yeah.
it? That
yeah.
A cartoonist was redolent for humour.
Mm.
Which is a very strange thing because actually it's a very static,
yeah.
Very...
Yeah.
monotonous
yeah.
Activity.
Yeah. I think just off the top of my head, I'm thinking that, you know, it gives him an excuse to be at home.
That's a good
point. With his wife and family rather than going out to work a la, you know, Terry and June or Fresh Fields.
That's a very good point because the situation, it's a bit like Father Dear Father.
Yeah.
The situation is that, so we have Dudley and Muriel and they've got grown-up daughters
yeah.
who move into the flat
yeah.
below them, don't
yeah.
they?
Yeah.
So they're kind of living at home but not at home, and the battle is in how much independence
yeah.
Dudley offers
yeah.
them.
Yeah, it's a weird, there's no kind of, it's not a clear-cut sit, is it?
No.
It's just, here are these people. I think one of the recurring things, having watched, you know, quite a few episodes of it recently, is that Dudley's really, it's touched on in this episode, Dudley's almost paranoid about his daughters and men.
Mm.
Susan had a boyfriend down there until after midnight.
Oh, which one?
But that kind of sort of seems to wax and wane depending on what other ideas are going on in the show.
The thing that... that really became apparent to me, and it's normally a thing that I cannot bear in sitcom, but I like it very much in this, which I think is a reflection of Robert Gillespie's. I normally cannot abide characters within sitcom who are, within the fiction of the sitcom, funny people.
Sing hosannas, praise the Lord, give thanks that he is safe returned, his golden beard glinting in the sun.
Did you get the breadcrumbs?
Yes.
That normally repels me in
yeah,
a sitcom.
Yeah.
I didn't like Peter Egan in Ever Decreasing Circles because he was thought to be a wit.
Yeah.
This is certainly the thing with actually Dudley and Muriel, that
yeah,
most
yeah.
of their chat is banter.
Yeah.
It's,
yeah.
It's
they
comedic
and they really zing.
What do they think of me these days?
The girls? Oh, opinion is divided. One of them thinks you're a bad-tempered, interfering old busybody, and the other one doesn't like you at all.
That came out better than I expected.
The premise of this, then, is that... Dudley's boss, played by Glyn Houston, shows up because there's a strike.
Yes, and it's very much
a
rooted
in Fleet Street. Yeah,
it's the winter of discontent in the comic industry.
And Dudley actually says
that is just typical of the British workman.
Yes.
So there's a strike, so they need to get ahead on pages of Barney the Barnet Bulldog. So Dudley is being offered a bonus if he can turn out 3 pages of comic strip overnight, so that so that Duncan can get ahead issues in the magazine. So then the idea is he has to pull an all-nighter.
Yep.
Then he ends up on jury duty the next day.
With hilarious consequences.
It's actually, I was quite, I think I'm going to say the word moved. I was moved by the fidelity that they have towards his process in cartooning, because we see him doing the kind of the rough layouts.
Yeah.
There's a lovely scene that starts with Stacey Dorning erasing the pencil lines from his finished ink work.
Yep.
I notice he draws on A2 size paper.
Well, that's interesting. That's a good spot.
Yeah, so the, which would probably be for someone like Polystyle or maybe a Looking Style magazine.
Well, I kind of I was planning to mention that I did think that they missed a trick back in the day with Looking, because they could have had a Keep It in the Family strip and a Barney the Bionic Bulldog strip. Perhaps on facing pages.
And one strip you could see the Barney within the context of the previous.
Absolutely. So, you know, if any of the members of the editorial team from Lookin' from 1980 are listening to this podcast, you know... Shame on you. Yeah, absolutely.
Something else that I like about it is that it's quite prosaic about some of the elements of home life. So there's a whole early sequence which is all about Dudley getting his hair cut at home by his wife, and there's kind of banter around that and chit-chat.
Well, there's a really good joke in there where Dudley's sitting on a chair as he would be at a barber's. Muriel's cutting his hair, and she hands him a mirror.
How do you like it at the back?
To check the back of his head. And he says, well, if I had a mirror in front of me, I could tell you. And it's a really kind of nice visual joke, which it's almost like he's kind of ad-libbing it. I'm sure he's not.
And then he seems to corpse or chuckle.
Yeah.
If I had a mirror, I could tell you.
Something that else also struck me, we've talked about the mundanity. But if I dare to bring this up, but Dudley and Muriel, they're a very sexual couple. There's a lot of racy chat, isn't there?
There is.
There's a bit where, is she teasing about what he's going to have for his dinner or something? And he says...
That's like blowing a kiss to a sex maniac.
People, for very good reasons, don't talk about sex maniacs anymore. But it did take you back to a time when people would use a phrase like that.
And he also, during that barber scene, where he makes some crack, doesn't he? That
I'm on the pill.
Can we talk also about some of the other kind of little details, which are quite funny, but kind of also root it in the time. There's a moment where the episode opens with Muriel and Jackie sitting at the kitchen table, and they're listening to some unidentifiable groovy music. Mm. And they turn off the radio. And then later on, when Dudley comes in, Muriel threatens to put Jimmy Young back on.
And then we see Stacey Dorning's Susan. What's the LP that she's carrying?
Giants of Boogie Woogie. I'm lost for words.
A generic prop.
Yes, but it didn't say anything about her character at all.
No.
There's one other little detail which I really like, where Dudley refers to one of the girl's boyfriends as...
The one with the electric hair.
Yeah, what does that mean?
I'm assuming he's a punk. There's this kind of residual... a slightly blated fear of punk, which kind of... I seem to recall punk turning up in Terry and June as late as 1985.
Please, June, what have you done to yourself?
Well, just following your instructions, I've been defrumping myself.
But June, your hair, your beautiful hair. Oh,
but it's a very kind of easily recognisable, you know, trope, to use a terrible word. You know, a father like Dudley would worry... about his daughter, you know...
Taking up with the punk.
Absolutely.
While we're talking about comedy punks, what are the parameters of Gizzard Puke?
I'm Gizzard Puke.
That separated him from Sid Snot.
Hello, Sid Snot here.
What would Gizzard do that Sid would...
I kind of pondered this much at the time.
Mm. I want to return to some of the sexiness, because in the trial that Dudley has to go to... So it's basically Pat Coombs.
Pat Coombs.
And she's been raped.
Well...
Or someone's tried to rape her.
Yes, yeah.
There's some glee, isn't there? Excitement that they're going to the trial of a molester.
I'm sorry?
I heard them chatting in the corridor. He's accused of molesting some woman. Only a little fella, too. Can't be any taller than you.
Again, it's not funny, but... you know, there's something about the word molester that kind of I don't quite know. It goes back to the thing about sex maniac.
Mm.
That somehow these things were kind of vaguely amusing.
When you hear them now, because they're so crude and on the nose, and unfinessed.
Yeah.
They almost have a naivety.
Yeah, absolutely. I would go along with that. There's a joke in the Pat Coombs courtroom scene where the judge asks her of her attacker.
Did he use an expletive?
And she says,
it didn't get that far. I think.
And at the time, I don't think I would got that joke on any level. But kind of again, that's a bit. You know, when you think about it, it's a bit.
And then he makes her write down that.
Well,
essentially,
this is the driver of the main joke of the whole show, isn't
which
it?
Is a good joke.
And what were the actual words that he used?
Oh no, I couldn't.
Well, it'd be most helpful.
Well, he said the. He said, how would you like me to blank, blank you?
Perhaps it would be better for Miss Petty if she wrote down that phrase.
Yes, my lord, yes. Would you?
It's a very clever joke in that he's fallen asleep and he's sleeping on quite
Mrs.
a
Dudley,
chatty... Yes, forgive me, after pulling his all-nighter, Dudley's fallen asleep on the female juror beside him.
By Anna Dawson, who I think was a bit of a mainstay of sort of Thames sketch shows of the era.
And the judge has had Pat Coombs write down the phrase that the would-be rapist used.
Which did include an expletive.
And the notice passed through the jury, and then the female juror passes it to Dudley, waking him in the process.
Read this.
Yes.
And then he thinks, because he's only just woken up, that this is a personal note from her to
what?
Read this.
It's actually very funny.
Well, he plays it beautifully, doesn't he?
And he takes about 20 seconds, doesn't he, of just silent reactions to reading the note.
You can actually see on his face the sort of the various thought processes and, you know, the kind of the logic of it must be from her, but that would be ridiculous. But what other explanation could there be?
That's a very kind offer, but I'm not...
I would quite like to talk a bit about Robert Gillespie, how he plays.
Absolutely.
There's something unusual when you see him because he's slightly camp or effete or fey, or there's certainly. I don't want to make any inference, but there is in a lightness of touch about how he does everything. A kind of a daintiness.
I think so. As I mentioned, talking about his face. He's a very good. He's full of energy, but not in a kind of slightly annoying kind of, you know.
Not in a hyper way.
No.
Not in a sort of a Timmy Mallet. But he is a sort of a man-child, isn't he?
He's very much a man-child. But I think you get the impression that from Robert Gillespie's performance that Dudley, you know, is a man sort of out of kilter with the world, but not in a kind of angry or cynical way.
No, in a good humoured, seeing the foibles of
absolutely.
Before they made you, they broke the mould.
Thank you. Before.
Something that is very charming now is that when they go into the break and also when they go into the end, the cast have to silently extemporize a longer at the end of their scene to cover for the break.
And
it's great, isn't it? Because we've got Robert Gillespie and Glenn Houston having a very overly animated conversation in the kitchen.
There's a lot of gesticulation in that scene.
And do you think, my feeling is that when they would do run-throughs on the day, the cast would say, no, well, that has to be in the moment. We won't do that. We'll just, let's see what we can find.
Well, I hope that's true. I like to think that they put a bit of themselves into these characters.
Yeah.
So that was only the third episode of Keep It in the Family that we watched. It actually ran 5 series in all, 31 episodes in total. And it came to an end in October 1983. What's interesting about that final series was that Pauline Yates had left by that point. So to fill the gap, they moved Dudley's boss, Duncan, into the house. Which seems a slightly unrealistic scenario to have your boss coming to live with you. How do you feel about that, Graham? Would you have enjoyed that, do you think?
Maybe this is the bit we fade out the chat. And you and I can instead we extemporize physically as if the end credits are playing the kind of animated conversation.
I'm already waving my hands and kind of scratching my head in a very kind of exaggerated fashion.
Today we watched The Living Soap and Keep It in the Family. And Chris, my question to you is, of those two, which do you think has more, in inverted commas, rewatchability?
I would definitely say Keep It in the Family has more rewatchability. It's not one of the most renowned sitcoms of its era. It's not one of the most feted sitcoms of its era. But it's really entertaining with some really kind of lively, energetic and quite original performances. I have to say it was actually really enjoyable to be reacquainted with The Living Soap. I wouldn't say it was the best made or most compelling show of its genre. I suppose it's kind of in a small but significant way, it's quite influential, but it just kind of felt really flat.
It is. I think in terms of talking points, you might say The Living Soap provides more because it's certainly a more ambitious, a more groundbreaking production.
Yeah.
But it's no Keeping It in the Family, is it?
It certainly isn't.
You've been listening to what we just watched from TV Cream, in which we watched The Living Soap from 26th of November 1993
and Keep It in the Family from the 14th of January 1980.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Next Monday, it's our last episode and it includes this.
I don't like his hair there, it looks all greasy.